Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Chris Gambino, the host for the channel. Today we'll be talking to Emma Maris about her new book, Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Welcome to the show, Emma.
It's great to be here.
Well, the book has certainly got a lot going on, but first let's talk about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm an environmental writer. I'm a freelancer. I started my career working for the scientific journal Nature in their Washington, D.C. office, reporting about sort of the world of science and also scientific discoveries. And my particular beat included conservation biology and ecology. So after I went freelance, I kept going with those fields because I'd become really interested in the things they were finding out, but also in the sort of values that were woven into those fields in a different way than in most scientific fields. And a lot of my work since then has been about the question of the values at the center of conservation. And this book is no different, except here I also talk about animal rights and animal welfare. So I sort of expand my focus a bit.
So let's talk about that expansion. Kind of what brought you to this very place in time to start asking these questions?
So I had been covering conservation for a long time, and around 2013, I moved to a new town, Klamath Falls in southern Oregon. And of course, the first thing I did was look around and try to see what the stories were that I could cover here. And one of the things that was very hot at the time was wolf reintroduction. Now, wolves were reintroduced into Idaho and Yellowstone in the 90s, but it took them a little longer to get to Oregon. So in 2013, there were still fewer than 100 wolves in the state, and they were just establishing themselves, and there were a lot of discussions about how we should live with them. So I became interested in that story, and there was, in fact, a kind of a famous wolf that lived really close to our town, a wolf that had it had a radio collar, and it had taken this really long journey from the northeastern part of the state all the way down to California. It was like 1,000 miles. So this is something wolves normally do. They disperse when they hit puberty to go find a mate and start their own family. Not unlike a lot of humans do. In this case, 1,000 miles was longer than researchers thought wolves went. They didn't know they just went that far. So this wolf became kind of OR7, as the scientists know him, became kind of a celebrity. So I was writing about OR7, and I kept having this nagging feeling that there was something weird about describing this wolf as a wild animal, because we knew exactly where he was at all times back then. He had a name. We had a sample of his blood. We had, I think, his DNA on file. We could tell who he was related to and who he wasn't related to. So if we found poop in the woods, we could tell if it was his or not. And when he started getting interested in livestock, there was hazing, there was, and the wolf plan suggested that if he got too interested in livestock, he would just be killed. And ultimately that last one in particular really gave me pause that if we could kill this wolf at any time, if it was living just thanks to our grace, so then how was that a really wild animal? And how was that not just sort of a free-ranging communal pet? I know that sounds a little dismissive, and I don't mean it to be, but I was struggling with what wild meant in this context. And so that really started me off on the project that ended up being this book. Now, the book has quite a few wolves in it, but it has all sorts of other animals too from all over the world. And the question kind of mutated beyond what is a wild animal to what are our ethical obligations to these animals that we describe as wild, these animals that aren't our pets or aren't our livestock, those animals out there. What are we supposed to do when the world that they are living in has totally been changed by humans and they're all kind of living in the situations that we've placed them in? What does that mean to us in terms of our ethical relationship with them?
Yeah, and the OR7 case was a great place to start. And we're jumping from Rambunctious Garden to Wild Souls. And as you noted, really trying to answer this question about the ethical obligation. And you do a great job unpacking it in so many ways. And you mentioned, and to not miss the point, that you're coming from the place of we've already, as humans, directly altered so much of their habitat. So now what are the rules and the norms and the morals that go along with interacting with these animals, and how are they potentially self-contradictory? So let's dive in. Let's talk about some of these rules. And then you ask some really big questions that kind of get into the power dynamics and the justice conversations around kind of whose rules are counting, whose don't, who's got money, who's got power. How does what we do in terms of these actions we take in the name of nature benefit different parties? So let's start unpacking some of that briefly as we move forward.
Sure. Sounds great.
So the very next conversation, right, is animals as kin. And where does this storyline historically fall? Are we prey? Are we predators to them? Or is there a kinship? Can you talk a little about some of the examples you use to really sort that conversation?
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of take an overview of how humans have conceptualized their relationship to wild animals in the past and in different places around the world. So I do that. It's not comprehensive. You could obviously write a whole book or a whole series of books about human relationships to wild animals. But I wanted to at least sort of take the readers on a little bit of a highlights tour. If only to sort of bring home this fundamental point, which is that there is no kind of one way to think about wild animals. So obviously our remote ancestors related to them in a very sort of just a bunch of animals out there interacting kind of way. Back many, many eons ago, we were prey and we were also predators and we were just one animal among many sort of mixing it up out there. And I think it was only pretty recently in our history that we started seeing ourselves as somehow different than these other animals. And there are certainly cultures where human exceptionalism is still not a thing, where humans are still just seen as one animal in this kind of web of prey and predators and cooperation and sort of mutual assistance. You know, there's all these relationships you can have. But this idea that humans aren't an animal somehow did become a powerful one in Western thought. So I talk about that quite a bit. Although I also kind of do a little bit of pushing back against that. There are even places within the sort of Western Christian-based culture where we do think about individual animals like they're kind of people with agency. So I have this whole interlude where I talk about this medieval practice of putting animals on trial for crimes. It's ridiculous in some ways, but because the idea that they could be morally or responsible for their actions doesn't seem to go with what we know about animal cognition and so on now. But at the same time, it shows that the humans of that time really did see these pigs and donkeys and even insects in some cases as actors in the world with agency who could make choices and sometimes made the wrong ones. So it was a really interesting, I mean, that kind of the sort of historical and cross-cultural research for this project was so fascinating, so much fun. And I kind of came out of it thinking that human exceptionalism, as in my last project, Rambunctious Garden, which was my first book, there I talk about all of the sort of, I think, errors in thinking that flow from this sort of humans aren't part of nature dichotomy, this human nature dualism. And that crops up again here, right? If we treat animals in a in a way that flows from the idea that we aren't animals, it often leads to dark and bad places. So I think the kinship model tends to lead us to better relationships with non-humans. And it's also just scientifically accurate at some level, because we're all evolved from the same common ancestor many millions of years ago. So we are relatives.
And you unpack this kinship with a bunch of different viewpoints and philosophies that are kind of wrestling with each other. And you start citing very different and different conversations, different people, and getting at these notions of, like you just mentioned, kind of where do we argue for kind of the morality of the animal, as well as kind of the sentient being. And one of the places you land is that I don't think anyone doubts that animals are sentient. And then there is some further discussion, kind of these notions of kind of reason. And you cite a particular book that's kind of talking about, essentially, we, right, as humans have values and the way we think, and therefore we test based on those. We look for whether or not animals have the qualities we think measure up to being their own entity, their own reasoning that they can argue, and things of that nature. Can you talk about some more of those philosophies that you get into in that chapter, and some of the people that you highlight, like Peter Singer or Ruth Harrison?
Yeah, so you know, this book is for a popular audience, but I try not to, I don't dumb it down. I just try to write in a way that everyone can understand. And it is, like you say, it's a pop science book, but it's also sort of a pop philosophy book. And I really do dig into these different philosophical approaches to thinking about non-human animals. And so, you know, the reader will get like a little introduction to Singer and his consequentialism, which is this idea that basically we should be looking at the consequences of all of our actions and whether or not they tend to increase the sum total of sort of happiness and pleasure in the world, or whether they decrease it. And it's all a big, in some ways, it's all a kind of a big happiness math problem. And then we have Tom Regan, a very influential guy who was more of a rights perspective. I kind of tend to think of him as an animal Kantian, right? It's this idea that, it isn't that we add up the consequences. It's just that these animals have fundamental rights to be treated well, and we can't break those rights. We can't infringe on those rights. So sometimes you get a different advice. If you have a moral conundrum and you go to kind of think about it through Peter's lens, or Peter Singer's lens, than you would get if you thought about the same conundrum through Tom Regan's lens. And I talk about other philosophers like Lori Gruen, who say that it's actually not so easy. There's not just one simple rule you can apply to every case. She uses the phrase entangled empathy to describe a kind of a more complicated case-by-case process where you take into account your emotional reaction to the situation as well as the consequences. And you also take into account your own relationship with the particular animal in question, which I think is really interesting. And I think actually Lori Gruen's account of how to make ethical decisions maybe does a better job of sticking closely to what we actually in practice do to make ethical decisions. The research shows that when we make decisions about what to do in ethical problems, we'd use a lot of our emotional processing to do that, as well as our rational processing. So, I mean, maybe Peter Singer himself can do it all with his rational brain, but I think most of us do use our emotions as part of our toolkit. And I don't think that's necessarily a drawback. I think our emotions often alert us to important features of these ethical conundrums. Anyway, these are just three, and there's many more. There's a lot of contemporary philosophers that I interviewed for the book, including Claire Palmer, who I think is brilliant. She's at Texas A&M. And I work with the work of Martha Nussbaum, who I also think is really brilliant. But for listeners who maybe are a little not sure about philosophy, trust me, like, I present this stuff in a way where you'll be able to understand it very easily. And the secret to philosophy is it isn't actually that arcane. It's just like a science in that it has its own vocabulary and its own kind of culture, and that can be really intimidating. But once you learn, you know, the kind of code words, it's not hard.
I'd agree with your statement. You give a very big overview of what's going on, and it actually is very engaging to bring us into kind of what are the conversations at play, and more so philosophy than science, but definitely in science, you have the name matters, right? They're always referring to like Kantian, right? The name matters because it ties you to a particular idea. And so that's important. And once you kind of get that jargon down of kind of who are they talking about and what does that mean, it flows. And so I think you do a great job there. Now to unpack what you started to get into, kind of the dichotomy between kind of values and then kind of the objectivity that we might want to make decisions or the rationality we want to make decisions with, you go back to another kind of wolf case that's in the state of Washington that really, I mean, broke my heart in a lot of ways to unpack that. And I was in the Pacific Northwest, and I probably should have known more about what was happening at the time. But the term genetic integrity shows up as a reasoning to take on particular conservationist motivations. Can you talk a little bit about that case study and genetic integrity?
Sure. So this took place when wolves were endangered, considered endangered across the state of Washington, and there was these two young wolves who were dispersing from their birth family, as is normal, and they came across a sheep herding dog. And these dogs are usually their kind of job is to scare off wolves, but in this case, for whatever reason, the sheep herding dog and the wolves kind of got along. And the wolves eventually ran off with the dog. The dog left his home and went off with these two female wolves, and they kind of formed a pack. And they were on the lam, as it were, for months. So this became a kind of a big deal locally. People were calling the two female wolves Thelma and Louise and everything. Local wildlife officials were made really nervous by this because they didn't want this dog impregnating either of these wolves because the offspring would be hybrids. They wouldn't be an endangered species and they wouldn't be a feral dog. They would be something in between. And so, you know, it became a sort of like an existential crisis for the Washington Department of Fish and Game. And they were able to track this little pack because one of the wolves had a collar on. And when they found them, one of them was pregnant. And so they essentially gave her an abortion and then sterilized her. So what I thought was so interesting about this case study, and they took the dog back home, and then, you know, there were kind of, you can read the book if you want to hear what happened to all three of the canines involved. But, you know, what I thought was really interesting about this as a case study was that there were two kind of notions of wildness opposed to each other here. One is this notion of genetic integrity, that the genome of these wolves was somehow wild, not domesticated, that it wasn't tainted with dog genes. Therefore, it was a wild genome that needed to be, its sort of purity needed to be protected from this hybridization event. But then there's this other notion of wildness, which is that you're wild. You get to do whatever you want. You don't have people tell you, like caging you up or telling you who to mate with or whatever. And in that case, that notion of wildness as autonomy was completely violated. You know, these animals had decided that they were going to be a family, and the state of Washington was like, oh no, you're not. So, you know, and that got to me too. Like at some level, I was annoyed on behalf of these animals that their choices were not honored. So I came to believe over the course of working on this book that, you know, in my previous book, I talked about how wilderness is mostly a myth. This idea that when white people stepped off the boat, that this was a virgin wilderness in North America is BS. And that it's a harmful myth because it erases indigenous people from history and from agency. And it also makes us obsessed with returning ecosystems to some sort of year zero, some sort of 1491 or 1850 or what have you. And that's no longer, it's an increasingly maladaptive goal for restoration anyway, because everything is changing, right? And here now I was finding a similar thing, that the kind of obsession with the past or pristineness or wildness was leading to what I thought were uncool outcomes that were not ideal, that were not maybe the most ethical. Now, Having said all of that, I do understand why the wildlife officials made the decision that they did. They were also working within a lot of bureaucratic restrictions, and their, you know, the laws about endangered species protection and so on that they were working with kind of forced their hand. I'm not annoyed with them at all. But I do think that it sort of solidified in my mind that I think the only kind of wildness that really ethically matters for non-human animals is their autonomy, not their purity. That's a red herring. It's does this animal get to make its own choices? That's a wild animal.
And you touched on two things here, and I was going to drive to I'm glad you brought up the autonomy. That's a really important point that you end on that I think needs to get handed off. And hopefully if the case wasn't made in the last like 2 minutes, the book will make the case for what you just mentioned in terms of driving for wild to become about autonomy and not just non-human or non-pure. And the interesting thing is, right, you talk about this idea of genetic integrity, but then and the argument to contain a pure or pristine line for the wolf, but at the same time, right, you start to wrestle with this notion that human influence is woven into genomes and the lives of species.
Yeah.
And that's in itself a conundrum, right? We're arguing that we need to maintain that we don't want these dogs to the wolf and the dog to mate. But how have you seen in your conversations and getting the book going, people recognize or unwilling to recognize for in another case that human influence is potentially woven into these genomes and the lives of these animals?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, so many of us were brought up with this idea that natural means that human, you know, lack of human influence, and that natural is the good that we should be pursuing in all of our conservation or environmental action. And that sort of baseline understanding can be really problematic because it tends to lead us to solutions that simply just involve removing the human influence. That's always often our go-to solution whenever there's a problem. We're like, we'll just put it back to the way it used to be. We'll just undo whatever humans did. And I think it's increasingly recognized that human influence on the planet has been massive and pervasive and also goes further back in time than we used to think. You know, I think more and more people now have even heard of this, the Pleistocene extinctions, and the concept that humans in prehistorical times probably had a hand in a lot of extinctions that changed ecosystems radically in North America and around the world too, Australia, New Zealand. The later a place was discovered by humans, the more profound the effect is. I think people are slowly coming to absorb this information, but I think it's still the case that often our kind of knee-jerk reaction is to try to go backwards or undo what humans have done. And also to withdraw or remove humans. And I think this is just not the right approach, right? I think what we, you know, think about almost any wild animal has been living in an ecosystem that's been shaped by Pleistocene extinctions, by land use change, by rising temperatures, rising carbon dioxide concentrations, that's been bisected by roads, the volume has been turned up with noise pollution, the lights have been turned up by by light pollution, everything has changed. And scientists are finding more and more instances of how animals have genetically changed to adapt to these new conditions. You know, there's behavioral plasticity, which I think is bigger than we expected in terms of, there's noise pollution, so I'm going to change the pitch of my mating song. Or, there's a bunch of people here now. Okay, I'm gonna just go nocturnal. I'm going to change my lifestyle to go out during the night so I don't run into as many people. There's a lot of that animals do, but then there's also a lot of like genome deep changes. You know, even wolves themselves, I talk in the book about how all those Pleistocene extinctions reshuffled the whole food web, and wolves, which were kind of like a meso predator back in the Pleistocene, they were kind of like a little guy, kind of almost more like what a coyote's role would be now. They kind of inherited this top predator role that went vacant when the dire wolves and the saber-toothed tigers all got extinct. So they are completely genetically, their whole species has been shaped by human activities.
Yeah, the megafauna and the hypercarnivore conversation was something that I really enjoyed wrestling with, and the ideas that it brings about and the impacts that it has, and the change in the way prey are and the adaptations to prey were really interesting. And I want to go back to this baseline because I want to emphasize it, or I want you to emphasize it. But you mentioned kind of this notion, and it comes back from the idea of wild. But before we move forward, let's go back to the conversation, kind of where we place as humans this notion of the baseline of nature, where that comes from and how it's a fallacy. Can you go back and kind of dig into that a little bit more before we move forward?
Yeah. This is something that, you know, I think that the field is kind of coming around on this, which is really exciting to see. But I do still think that lots of people in the lay, just sort of the general public are these ideas that it's good to kind of keep talking about this, I think, right? So I think a lot of us grew up with this idea that, when Christopher Columbus stepped off the boat, North America and South America were vast wildernesses lightly populated by a few native tribes who lived in harmony with the nature and basically had no effect on the ecology. They just kind of lightly creamed off a few resources. This is basically the received notion that I was taught as a child and that I think a lot of us were taught. And it's just wildly incorrect, right? North and South America were very densely populated with like cities and roads and trade networks and the land management that happened was extensive. It was, you might have heard about Native Americans burning the prairies to keep them a grassland and to keep the game there and to get new growth of useful plants. And that's just one example of the kind of thing that was happening coast to coast and all up and down the Americas. And in all other places too, in Australia, in New Zealand, other places that had been that were eventually colonized, there were also a lot of land management strategies. And I really enjoy, like before COVID, when I did more traveling to give lectures, one of my favorite things to do is if I was going to a new place, I would dig in and try to learn as much as I could about that pre-contact environmental history. And often, it's hard to find, like it's buried in weird old obscure anthropology journals, but you can find it. Like I went to San Diego to give a lecture and I found out all about how the native people there had these big oak gardens and they'd have them in one place. And then 100 years later, the climate would have changed slightly and they'd move the oak orchards to a new location where they would do better. And they moved prickly pear cactus from inland deserts all the way out to the coast because they were a food resource. And they also used them to make fences around their villages, which is pretty brilliant because they're all spiky. And they had these whole grasslands that they had set up, that were like, and when Spanish explorers got there, they were like, oh, it looks like fields. It looks like agriculture, but they didn't take that last step and say, oh, it is fields. It is agriculture. This land is all being managed. They just couldn't believe that these people were capable of doing that. And there were these subtle differences, like the orchards weren't planted in rows, for example. So they were like, oh, look at these oaks. How handy that they all grow right by the village. like they just couldn't see it. So the North and South America, most of the world has been radically changed and managed by humans for thousands of years. That's the baseline. That's the truth. And yet we still decide whether a place is natural or not, or in good shape or not, or has ecological integrity or not by comparing the way it looks now to the way it looked in some year X. And that year is different in different parts of the world, but it's often very much pegged to when the first white people showed up, because they saw themselves as the only people on the planet with any real agency. So it made sense that they would see any changes that they made to the landscape as somehow unnatural. Whereas any changes that the native people made to the landscape, they just kind of lumped that in. There's a famous quote where some North American ecologist says that their native changes to the ecosystem were like the changes of beaver or deer. They didn't count. So they're basically saying they're like non-human. So I think the field is very much wrestling with this right now. I've been doing some academic work on this as well, writing about ecological integrity and genetic integrity in the environmental ethics literature, and also getting some of it published in the restoration and conservation biology literature to try to keep these conversations moving. But there's still lots of policies and stuff that, you know, there's a lot of state and federal, national level agencies that use measurements of ecological integrity to prioritize where parks should be. And those measurements of ecological integrity, when you unpack them, they're basically counting species and comparing them to what species were in that exact same spot in 1850.
So I appreciate you bringing back that baseline conversation, taking a segue a little bit, but it's really relevant to the points and arguments you're making about this idea of wild, this idea of natural, and kind of where we decide to make changes and how we adapt and or how comfortable we are with change. And I want to bring it back to the animal side of thing. And I also want to unpack a little bit, or at least discuss this notion you've been talking about, this dichotomy between non-human and human and natural and non-natural. But for those who are listening and might be wrestling, this might be new for them, I want to bring up the points that you make. So you make two kind of connecting themes here. One, you say we can revel in the non-human without disdaining the human, right? And so that's some of the arguments you've been making, is that human influence has happened. We just discussed it, right? The original indigenous populations were making an impact. And it's not necessarily good or bad. They have an impact. And so you're arguing that it's not going back, it's not pausing, it's not stopping, we just have to navigate those. But then at the same time, which is really important, right? You're not just like ultimately pro humans can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
You talk about that rejecting this dichotomy does not mean condoning all human actions, because as animals, everything we do is natural. That using natural as a substitute for good is the problem here, not the solution. And that is quoted directly from page 66 of the text. Can you talk a little bit more about how you kind of move from, we have an impact, but that doesn't mean we get to do whatever we want?
Yeah. So this is, thank you. Thank you for asking this question, because I think it's one that really does come up in people's minds when they're working through this idea of like, well, if we're not going to try to make it look like it did in the past, then what are we, then is it anything goes? And the answer is no, it is not anything goes, because there are still lots of other values out there in the natural world that we want to try to protect and preserve beyond this quote unquote naturalness or this lack of human influence, right? There's diversity, there's complexity, there is, you know, just abundance of non-humans. So we want our world to have lots of different species in it, and we want those populations of those other species to be robust, and there to be a lot of them, and we want them all to be interacting in complicated and interesting ways. And we want them to, as much as possible, to have their own individual autonomy out there in the world. So we can try to do all of those things without falling back on this notion of natural or this idea that we have to subtract humans from the equation to get there. I think a lot of people have been reading Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass, and this is ultimately her message here, is that the way to solve our environmental problems is not to withdraw, it's to have better relationships with the non-human world. So that doesn't mean anything goes, because you're still not allowed to have crappy relationships that are exploitative and destructive and that ultimately are going to lead to the extinguishment of the non-humans, right? You want to have relationships with the non-human world that are mutualistic, right? Rather than just exploitative. So I think that is a really exciting way to proceed. And I am very excited that people are more and more getting on board with these ideas. So does that mean that environmental history is totally irrelevant when it comes to management? Absolutely not. Does that mean we should never try to make things look like the past? No, it doesn't. There's certainly cases where we might want to say, hey, you know, there used to be this this, let's say there used to be an indigenous oak orchard kind of ecosystem in this area that in the past ecologists thought was just a natural oak grassland kind of deal. And now we realize that it was actually probably a managed system, but like, that doesn't mean we can't want to restore that and have that and celebrate that. And maybe even start harvesting some of those acorns and eating them again. We can totally look to history. We can totally engage with the traditions of the land. And sometimes that might look on the surface quite a bit like the kind of old school, let's just put everything back restoration, except we're seeing it in a different way. And we don't have to do the same thing everywhere. In some other places, we might say, okay, so in 1850, there used to be this animal and this plant here, but those animals and those plants are not going to be able to thrive here now because of climate change or because there's a freeway here or whatever. But we could have these other animals, these other plants here, they would do really well and they need some habitat. So let's do that. And ultimately, I am just more interested that our world's amazing diversity persists into the future than I am that it's all in the quote unquote right place.
And I think that you said it perfectly, kind of quoting from the Braiding Sweetgrass text, but about the relationship, right? And it's ultimately you can't have destructive relationships. And that's something that we have to bring to the table and think about our involvement. And we don't want those in our lives, human to human. And now we got to figure out kind of what does that look like, human to non-human world. And I want to bring out, you pointed to kind of like, it doesn't mean like doing all this, thinking this way doesn't mean there can't be a you didn't say preference. You did say it in your text though, a preference for the past, right? But that conversation about like putting things back to like a particular place and time and making it look like that can't be a scientific argument necessarily. Then you want people to recognize and at least admit that it's a preference, not just science says that this is better. This is a better environment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I think there was a phase where ecologists or restorationists would say the correct state of this ecosystem is such and such because that's what it looked like. And there still is that kind of strain. You know, you still see these sort of ecological assessments where they say, well, this site is intact. This site is degraded. Those kinds of words sound scientific, but they're premised on the idea that the intact system is the superior, morally acceptable, good system. But it's all pegged to a cultural baseline, and that wasn't being acknowledged, and it was driving me bonkers. And that is why I wrote two books about this. Acknowledging that this is a cultural preference or a human preference that we want this to look like it did in a certain time, that doesn't mean we can't do it. It just means that we have to admit that ecology doesn't tell us that we need to make it look like this.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you unpacking that point. Biodiversity, you said that can be one of our big goals. So now let's blow some minds a little bit more. I'm going to ask the question because you made it a chapter title. Are species valuable?
Yeah, this was the most difficult part for me in writing this book, because the notion that an extinction is bad and that species are good is so fundamental to not only my worldview, but to my personal identity. You know, this is something that's like really deep to me. And yet, when I started really digging into the environmental ethics literature about the value of biodiversity, I found myself in a confusing position. So there's more than one type of value, and I unpack them in the book. But very briefly, you can divide value up into the sort of two categories: the instrumental value, the value that something has because you can use it. And then there's the sort of intrinsic value, and that's the value it has just for being itself. And I think most people who care about the environment are interested in that intrinsic value. They are, you know, even kind of sometimes contemptuous of people who value nature because you could chop it down or you can eat it or you can hunt it or you can... But at the same time, you know, the values like wetlands filtering water or providing mangrove swamps, providing buffers for storm surges, like these are definitely things we should pay attention to and protect. This kind of instrumental value can be substantial. But most people's heart is really in the intrinsic value half of that equation. And that's where my heart was as well. But then you get into complicated ethical questions like, is it still intrinsically valuable if there's nobody around that values it intrinsically? Is it somehow a sort of a metaphysical property that that exists in the biodiversity itself? Or is it because there's lots of people and lots of non-human sentient creatures that like biodiversity that it's valuable? So that is a tricky one. And once you get to this kind of, once you sort of say, well, it doesn't even matter if there are people or beavers or bears around to enjoy it or to love it, nature, quote unquote, or the natural world or the non-human world is still valuable. Diversity is still valuable, even if there's no one to value it. And even if nobody uses it for anything, it's just valuable because it is. Like, I believe that, but I don't feel like the people who have tried to prove it have proven it in a kind of a scientific way, you know? And it makes it trickier because species seem like the real things in the universe. And I think they are real things in the universe. Matt Barker, if you're listening to this at Concordia University, this is what he studies. We've had lots of conversations about it, but species are fuzzy, right? So some people will say, oh, these two things are the same species. And other people might say, oh no, they're just subspecies of the same species. There's a lot of disagreement, and there's no actual scientific test that you can do to say, are these two things part of the same species or are they a separate species? It has to be, in the end, it's a human categorization. It's a human judgment call, because that's not how evolution works. Evolution doesn't make neat categories. It makes blurry categories. So So should we, you know, if we're just like, well, should we uproot this forest of rare orchids? They might be a species or they might only be a subspecies. That seems like an academic point. Like, no, don't uproot the forest of rare orchids. My goodness, keep it. But when you start killing animals to save the rare orchids and the animals suffer when they die, then I think, oh, okay, now we're asking to do some kind of ethical trade-off here between suffering and biodiversity. And so now I feel like we need to really prove that this biodiversity is valuable. And I think that's where it gets harder, because what if the orchids are very similar to another kind of orchid that's incredibly common all over the country? And in order to save this very, very similar but very slightly different orchid, we have to kill like a million cats with poison that takes a week to kill them. Now I'm not so sure, right? Like, now I'm a little nervous. So I think that I don't give answers to these questions, I give answers to some questions, right? Like, I have a chapter about zoos and I'm like, no, some of the stuff they do in zoos is not okay. But in this case, I don't think that I can give answers, because I think it has to be a case by case ethical decision-making process. What I'm really calling for is just for people to realize the ethical complexity here and to kind of go through that process rather than just being like, yep, it says on this paper that this is a subspecies, so let's go ahead and slaughter these millions of cats.
Yeah, it you do open up a lot of conversation, but you start with kind of people's baseline for what they might be valuing, or the typical way to value, which has essentially a number value. And you talk about kind of not in this chapter per se in terms of invasives, maybe a little bit, but you talk about more endangered species and why they might become more valuable based on kind of the equation that goes along with it. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how you've shifted, and you talked about it just a bit ago, but talk about the baseline of how most folks are considering that there's a higher value for something endangered based on this kind of equation.
So people in the conservation world are mostly interested in keeping the kinds of life that exist flourishing. They are not interested in the individuals that make up those populations. They might as individual people be interested in animal welfare, but as conservationists, that's just not part of the field, part of the discipline. Animal welfare is not really part of the discipline. So for a conservationist that's worried about extinction, a really common species, an individual of a really common species, is not worth very much. But an individual of a very rare species is worth a lot more, because you need that individual to be in the breeding population. You need it to be there to help the whole population persist. So actually, one thing that is interesting about this valuation system is that it does mean that once an individual animal, for example, is no longer breeding anymore, it becomes essentially useless from the conservationist point of view because it's no longer going to contribute anything to future generations, which is why you get things like this, the Cecil the Lion controversy, right? Because there's a whole other group of humans out there that don't think about primarily about species and populations and extinctions. Their primary focus is about the happiness of individual animals. And so Cecil the Lion was a big old lion that was killed in a hunt that was, I think there was some dubiousness about the where it was, like whether it was in the right place or whatever, but it was within the framework of conservation hunting in Africa, which is an ongoing practice in which a sort of what conservationists consider to be sustainable numbers of animals are hunted at high dollar prices, and some of that money goes to conservation. So people who care mostly about the happiness of individual animals were horrified that this big, beautiful old lion was shot. But conservationists really, I mean, people who are mostly oriented towards the conservation perspective really didn't care because he was no longer breeding. He was done. He'd been ousted from his pride, and he was like at that point essentially surplus to requirements. So I think that a case like that shows how different these two different ways of thinking are when it comes to these kinds of ethical decision-making conundrums. And what I wanted to do in the book was help people who care about both of these things, who care about extinctions and they care about the happiness of individual animals. Like, how the heck do you live that life? Like, what does that look like? Can you have both of those things at the same time?
And one thing you start to unpack and move towards is the notion of compassionate conservation. And you kind of detail your experiences and your time spent in Australia. And as we're coming to a close, I've got a couple more questions. But if we can briefly, can you talk about your experience working alongside in Australia, folks focused on compassionate conservation, and a little bit about that case study and the dog fence, and another kind of, in my experience, kind of heart-wrenching story.
Yeah, so Australia is I end up going to Australia twice for this book because it's a place where a lot of these ethical conundrums are really playing out, because one of the dominant drivers of extinction in Australia is introduced predators, cats and foxes, and rats too, but cats and foxes are really the focus. And they also, so they do a ton of killing there, conservation killing. They also do a lot of killing of exotic or introduced species like horses and donkeys and camels. And they also kill dingoes, which are sort of introduced, but they were introduced like 3,000 years ago. So they're also kind of native. It's a very much a gray area. So there's just a lot of killing of animals there. And so it just seemed like a place where I needed to go to understand some of these questions. And I spent some time with a group of compassionate conservationists. That's this term they've invented. And they're trying to figure out how you save species without killing anybody, without killing any animals. And it was fascinating to hang out with them, to see the world through their worldview, and to kind of go through all these hypothetical examples around the campfire with them. I do think that there are places where I disagree with them. This notion that there are never acceptable, there's never an acceptable way or time to kill an animal to achieve other goals. I think that I'm willing to kill animals sometimes to achieve certain goals, like saving a species. However, I have a lot of respect for their passion, for their compassion, and for the attention that they've brought to how easily the conservation community will go to killing. While I still think that killing might be part of a toolbox, I think that the sort of being like, okay, this is a problem. Let's get out the poison. Let's get out the trap. Let's get out the guns. Like, I do think that people go to it very quickly. And I also think that conservation doesn't necessarily process it psychologically very well in terms of the sort of grief or the kind of heaviness that comes with killing that many animals.
And as we transition, one other thing you point to is kind of what's going on there is that there's some hindsight that's lost in the transition of governments and politics, where kind of the measurements of whether or not these killings are successful and actually create or accomplish anything kind of gets lost. There's not really a good tracking system at play. And that's one of the arguments that's made in that case. And so as we transition out, we ask a very typical last question. In this case, I'm going to reframe it for you and give us a 1 minute solution to kind of how can we be good humans in a non-human world?
Great. So I think the secret to trying to achieve this is, first of all, realizing that you're never going to be perfect. Like, there's in some of these questions, like should you kill a bunch of cats to save a rare native species? There isn't an answer that doesn't involve some kind of painful action that you're going to feel bad about. If you decide to do the killing, there's some grief that goes along with that. And if you decide not to do the killing and the animal goes extinct, there's some grief that goes along with that. So philosophers call this moral residue, the sort of the bad stuff that you have to do because it's the least bad option that you could come up with. So I think the first thing to know is that there's no way to get through this life without some moral residue. Like we all have to make decisions about what to do, what to eat, where to put our money, how to live our lives. And there's moral residue attached to all of those decisions. There's no way to not impact other species as we move through our lives. We are ecological beings. We are animals. And everything we do does impact the other parts of the food web. So I think the best that we can do is to try to be thoughtful about our decisions, to try to keep the autonomy of individual non-humans in mind as we make our decisions, to try to protect the biodiversity of life, and to try to balance all these things with humility, knowing that we're not always going to make the right decision. We're not always going to achieve our goals, and sometimes we're going to mess up. But I think we have to just do the best we can, knowing that the best is never going to be good enough.
Well, I really am thankful, Emma, that you put your wrestling into words and on paper. And thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.